magazine.
Bien sûr.
À ce qu'il y a.
Présentation, Pamela Sumba.
Bonjour et ravi de vous retrouver sur Channel Africa, la voix de la Renaissance africaine, comprise par Sarafina. Catherine, dans les cas et à la technique, et voici le menu du jour.
Good evening and welcome to Africa Digest. You're listening to Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance, broadcasting live from Johannesburg on the frequency 1523 kHz on the 99th band to West Africa. I'm Jazz Arad on the show with me with the news and Panama Shaka. We start in Matabula with your economics report and Mosibudi Makura with your sports. Our top stories here on Africa Digest this hour. SADC mediator announces that the Lesotho Parliament will reconvene in 2 weeks. Guinea commemorates its independence. And in economics, South Africa's consumer confidence dips by 5 points in the third quarter of the year. Sports-wise, head coaches and technical directors of national associations gather in Egypt for the FIFA CAF conference. Now with the news, here's Amanda.
Good evening.
that is facilitated the Tutu Cyril Ramaphosa has announced that any elections will be held in the Mountain Kingdom in February next year. He says the Tutu's parliament will reconvene on the 17th of this month. Ramaphosa says elections are essential for a return of stability in the country. The city has been in turmoil since the Prime Minister Tom Tabane claimed a top general had attempted to seize power. Ramaphosa has been speaking at a media conference in Maseru.
National general elections will be held towards the end of February 2015 and on a date that will be determined by His Majesty, the King. In other words, the time frame has been set and His Majesty, the King, will determine the exact date on which those elections will be held.
The International Monetary Fund is to give $150 million of financial assistance to the three countries in West Africa hard hit by the Ebola crisis. Nigeria, Guinea, and Sierra Leone are facing flooding droughts and disruptions to agriculture, mining, and services because of the outbreak. More than 5,000 cases and over 2,600 deaths have been reported since the outbreak. Christine Lagarde, Managing Director of the International Monetary Fund, says the international community must rally to help the countries worst hit by the crisis.
So the Ebola virus is causing not only humanitarian terrible damage on both Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia, but it's also causing economic damage. So the three countries ask for help, and today we have approved a package of $130 million that will go to support those three countries. The money is going to help the three countries as budget support. They clearly need to use those funds to fight the consequences of the virus.
Thanks to the protection of up to seven people as they try to control clashes between armed groups in the Central African Republic town of Bambari that have lost at least 16 people dead. Bambari has become a stronghold for the Muslim flag rebels that seized control of the country last year and the fourth end of terror in January. Factions of the Suliga have clashed with each other, as well as the mostly Christian anti-Taliban militia and armed killer tribesmen in recent months. Funding clashes broke out yesterday in Bambari. Here, clashes took place in Bambari, June and July, leaving more than 100 people dead and at least 200 injured, mostly civilians. Tens of thousands fled. Tibetan leader the Dalai Lama has accused South Africa of fooling a single person after authorities failed to give him a visa to attend a summit of Nobel Peace Laureates. The Buddhist cleric says the Nobel Peace Summit that was scheduled to be held in Cape Town to honor fellow laureate Nelson Mandela was cancelled because the South African government wouldn't allow him to attend. The country's international relations earlier strongly denied it had refused the Tibetan leader a visa. China, a close ally of South Africa, has rejected calls over the years for Tibet to be granted autonomy. Meanwhile, Tibetan Mayor Patricia Berlin has announced that the 14th World Summit of Nobel Peace Laureates to be held in the city will be suspended. Another location will also be considered to relocate the summit to an alternative venue. Berlin explains.
After extensive consultations and deliberations, it has been decided that the 2014 World Summit of Nobel Peace Laureates planned for the 13th to the 15th of October 2014 in Cape Town will be suspended. The primary location is the fact that the South African government has refused to grant Holiness the Dalai Lama in order to attend the Peace Summit.
He says the state and defense have concerns about unregulated media access to Durrani. CMPA service has no objection to closing arguments and closing fees that apply. That was confidential.
Africa Digest.
You're listening to Africa Digest.
SADC facilitator and South African Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa has just made a major announcement relating to his facilitation efforts in Lesotho. The announcement was made at a press briefing in Maseru, where he was joined by leaders of political parties in Lesotho, as well as SADC Deputy Executive Secretary Thando Mkhondo. On Tuesday, two policemen in Lesotho were wounded during a shootout between the police force and the military. Ramaphosa subsequently called for an investigation into the shooting. He was in the country as part of his Southern African Development Community mandate to facilitate talks and find a solution after an attempted coup by the military on August 30th. The city correspondent, Nsakwane Ngakane, earlier joined us on the line to tell us more.
Well, essentially the agreement, as you've mentioned, says Parliament will reconvene on the 17th of October. It says Parliament will again dissolve in December in time for an early election at the end of February or towards the end of February 2015. And of course, the King will use his prerogative to decide when exactly this will happen, as Parliament will reconvene after the 17th of October.
Now, South African Deputy President also announced the status of parliamentary duties when it reconvenes. Now, does this mean the motion of no confidence against Prime Minister Tom Tabane falls away under the new agreement?
That's clearly what it means. And of course, all the political parties that are in Parliament have signed this declaration that is now called the Maseru Declaration. And essentially, it is to pass a budget, as Deputy President Ramaphosa said, to reconvene election, or rather for the holding of elections in February 2015.
During the press briefing at signing, did you get the sense that everyone was on board with this agreement?
Well, you know that when you have differing sides and everyone came in with their own agenda in terms of what they expected to get out of the talks, you won't necessarily have everyone happy with the outcome. But what Deputy President Ramaphosa said is that all the parties seem to agree that they want to go to elections and get a fresh mandate from the people of Lesotho. What is not seen, though, and that he only mentioned afterwards, is civil society concerned that the constitution of Lesotho should be reformed in time for elections to enable coalition parties or rather governments to survive in Lesotho, because currently it only provides for a government from one party with a prime minister from a mandate from one party.
Now, what will happen to the various security apparatus deployed in the country to maintain stability?
According to the president, that continues until all the way after elections in 2015. The SADC mission was initially intended for 3 months, but it will continue all the way to following the elections after February 2015. And also, SADC is also intending
of course, as usual, observer
missions that
can
ensure that the elections are free and
fair.
He has called on the IEC to ensure that the elections are credible and free and fair.
So, Kwame, the issue of
two-state shooting,
how was it addressed?
He has specifically answered this by saying that SADC will look into the security situation in Maoji after the reconvening of Parliament, and that SADC will look at this during its mission while it is in the Lesotho. He didn't specifically say, because he was asked specifically who the commander of the army is. He says, well, what he has done is that with the security agents in Lesotho to ensure that they put the people of Lesotho first and to ensure that they work with the SADC mission to resolve the security crisis in the country.
That was our Lesotho correspondent, Nsakwane Ngakane, earlier joining us on the line from Maseru. You just tuned in, welcome to Africa Digest. I'm Jack Alon. Guinea is today marking its 56th anniversary of independence from France. French Guinea was established in 1891, taking the same borders as the previous colony of the Rivière du Sud. Prior to 1882, the first four portions of French Guinea were part of the French colony of Senegal. In 1891, Rivière du Sud was placed under Colonial Lieutenant Governor at Dakar, who had authority over the French coastal region east to the modern Benin. In 1894, Rivière du Sud, Côte d'Ivoire, and Dahomey were separated into independent colonies, with Rivière du Sud being renamed the Colony of France.
In 1958, the French Fourth Republic collapsed due to political instability and its failures in dealing with its colonies, especially in Burkina and Algeria.
The founding of the First Republic was supported by the French people, while French President Charles de Gaulle made it clear on the 8th of August in 1958 that France's colonies were to be given a strong choice between more autonomy and a new French colony and immediate independence in the referendum to be held on the 28th of September in the same year. The other French colonies changed the form of Guinea under the leadership of Ahmed Sékou Touré, whose Democratic Party of Guinea had won 56 of 56 in the 1957 territorial election, voted overwhelmingly for independence. The French withdrew quickly, and on the 2nd of October in 1958, Guinea proclaimed itself a sovereign and independent republic with Sékou Touré as president. Following France's withdrawal, Guinea quickly aligned itself with the Soviet Union and adopted socialist policies. This alliance was short-lived, however, as Guinea moved towards a Chinese model of socialism. Despite this, however, the country continued to receive aid and investment from capitalist countries such as the United States. Even the relationship with France improved under the election of Henri Giscard d'Estaing as president. Trade increased and the two countries exchanged diplomatic visits. The West African nation, beginning this July, suffered the most severe recorded outbreak of Ebola in history, which rapidly spread to neighboring countries Liberia and Sierra Leone. Reporting for Channel Africa, I'm Sengobele in Johannesburg.
Very nice, Matonga. More than 100 demobilized militia fighters and their family members have died from starvation and disease in the remote military camp in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Human Rights Watch says the government kept the former fighters in the northwestern Kutakrawli camp much longer than they intended 3 months and failed to provide enough food and health care. The demobilized fighters belong to armed groups that remained active in eastern DRC at the end of the Civil War more than a decade ago. More than 900 surrendered fighters and several hundred family members were sent to the camp in September 2013 to wait for integration into the country or into civilian life. Annika van Rodenburg, senior researcher for the Democratic Republic of Congo in Human Rights Watch Africa Division, says authorities told Human Rights Watch that the government didn't have the means or the capacity to provide provisions to the ex-combatants.
We also spoke to the Congolese Minister of Defense. He also claimed that he was aware that there had been problems at this camp, and he lamented that there wasn't enough money, he claimed, from the donors to be able to start the demobilization program, and that it had been very difficult to get food and provisions into this camp. Now, all of that might be true, but that really to Human Rights Watch is irrelevant. The government moves the people to this particular location. Their excuses and their hand-wringing at this particular point in time is simply not good enough. They moved them there, they decided to take them there. It was their responsibility to ensure that they treated them well, basic human decency in the environment where they took them. The Congolese government didn't do that. It's criminal, their behavior. They are required by international law to provide basic human services to individuals who are ex-combatants. They haven't done so. And so I think, to me, these excuses run very thin, and what's needed now is not lots of hand-wringing and not lots of, we're sorry, this is happening to people. What they need to do is to act. They got to move these people, and they need to ensure they get this right for the future, because if they want other groups to be mobilized, that isn't going to happen. They're leaving people to starve and to die in their droves, which is what they were doing in Africa.
Does the government have, you know, other alternatives? I mean, if supplies were getting low and the government said they could no longer take care of the men and their families, couldn't they have found other alternatives, like, for instance, maybe give them seeds to plant so that they can feed themselves?
Those are all very good questions, and I believe these are questions that should go to the Congolese government. You know, why didn't they do more for these people? Why didn't they bring in more medication, more equipment, more food? Why didn't they give people more money to be able to buy some degree of food? Certainly this location is extremely isolated, and planting is quite difficult. It is in the middle of the jungle in western Congo. So this is rainforest terrain, where people from Eastern Congo have little experience in how to do agriculture. But I think the community just needs to answer to why on earth they took the man in the first place and then abandoned them. Because that's what they did. And as a result, more than 100 ex-combatants and their families did.
And could you call the neglect of the former fighters and their families a criminal act by the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo?
Yes, it is, because it is clear under international law that it is the responsibility of the Congolese government to ensure that ex-combatants who have surrendered to them are well treated. This is under international law and the Geneva Convention. Sending them to an isolated location where they have no access to food and medication clearly violates that particular principle of the Geneva Convention. And it is criminal that the Congolese government did not look after them and in fact left them to die. I very much hope that the investigation the Congolese government says it has ordered will look at who is responsible for this and will then bring criminal charges against the individuals who are responsible, because this kind of neglect cannot and should not continue.
But do you know which part of government was supposed to be responsible for the rehabilitation of the
Congolese? Well, indeed, yes. We know, of course, that one of the primary responsible agents for this was the demobilization program run by General Delphine Kahindi. He is the general in charge of the demobilization program. He's, at the moment, his title is the pre-demobilization and disarmament coordinator, but the program is yet to fully start. Now, that particular component of demobilization planning falls under the Ministry of Defense. And so it is also the Minister of Defense who needs to take responsibility and make sure that action is taken, that investigations conducted, those responsible are held to account, and that those that are still in the camp are moved to better locations.
And, you know, there are still some arms in the Democratic Republic of Congo that the government, you know, and indeed the international world is hoping to have ways to lay down their arms. Now, this is no reason to have a country.
That, of course, is what's so lamentable about what has happened, is that there are thousands of people that still need to be demobilized in Eastern Congo and in Southern Congo. And this kind of treatment of those who have voluntarily surrendered is not only criminal, it's, of course, so counterproductive to trying to bring peace in Eastern Congo. If you're going to try and encourage people to lay down their arms and to stop fighting, they need to be assured that they're going to be treated well, that they're not going to be sent to the middle of nowhere to starve and die. So, I mean, this is so lamentable. I think this will have an extremely negative impact on future demobilization programs. It, of course, sends such a bad signal. And I think that's why the government needs to publicly and urgently make amends here and ensure that what's happening is corrected and corrected quickly. Because only by doing that will we ensure that future combatants have any degree of confidence in the government. I think one other way to move that forward now is it's clearly time for the United Nations peacekeeping mission in Congo, UNISCO, to also step up and play a bigger role in the demobilization and disarmament program, because these combatants who are hopefully will surrender are going to need some kind of guarantee that the international community is looking at this closely and isn't going to leave them to suffer like these people have.
That's Annika von Wurttemberg, senior researcher on the Democratic Republic of Congo and Human Rights Watch Africa Division, speaking to Josefa Bingato. This is Channel Africa, South Africa's only official international public radio station on shortwave, internet, and satellite. From an African perspective, listen to Channel Africa in English, Swahili, French, Lozi, Portuguese, and Kinyanja, informing the world about Africa. Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance. This is Africa Digest. I'm Jazarov. Still up ahead, we've got Wisani Matabula with our economics report in about 20 minutes from now. And our sports report, final one for the day, is none other than Rachel Makura. A two-day seminar on the charter of African Renaissance. and consultation on the African Union Agenda 2063 is currently underway in Pretoria, South Africa. South Africa's Minister of Arts and Culture, Nathan Tetwa, earlier launched the charter. At the launch of Tetwa, called on South Africans to make more efforts in familiarizing themselves with the African culture. The event is part of a consultative process on the charter that will serve as a platform to promote the effective implementation of the charter in South Africa. The event is being attended by African cultural experts and art practitioners. Mention spokesperson at the Department of Arts and Culture, Zandile Meme.
I think it's very important for us to conceptualize the whole idea of the Charter for African Cultural Renaissance. This makes South Africa the eighth country to ratify this document. And we are very proud to be in the first group that has been created for nine. Specifically, the aim of the Charter is to promote and assess the philosophy of Pan-Africanism, where African people of this country, in the continent, and all over the world, begin to embrace themselves and love themselves and do not apologize to anybody for being who God has made them out to be. For too long, African people have defined themselves and look at themselves through colonial or Western eyes, if you like, and says that we are an African people, and there is absolutely nothing deficient about us. And it is in this background and context that the Minister of African Culture in South Africa, Mr. Nathan Tetwa, has actually dedicated the entire month of May in 2015, which is next year, to a celebration of African culture, and we'll be inviting creative intellectuals from the continent and all over the world who do music, literature, dance, even such new meaning, to come here and begin to uphold and promote this African cry. And today marks a very important beginning to that program, in that, of course, we had this launch where the first minister outlined the vision and the program, and of course, he was joined by Ms. Angela Martin, who is the head of culture at the African Union Commission.
What are some of the topics that will be discussed at this 2-day seminar? It's very important.
Well, this afternoon at 6:30, there will be a seminar on the charter implementation, right? And there will be a presentation on the political imperative of the charter, the economic imperative of the charter, the cultural orientation of the charter, and of course the social imperatives of the charter. And then tomorrow this will carry on where we have discussions on consultations with the African Union Agenda 2063, which is an important document that outlines the place that Africa as a continent wants to be in the next 5 decades or so. And of course there'll be an overview of the African Union Agenda from 2063, and of course there'll be feedback on the consultation with the continental cultural and creative sector, which will be given by Simpiwe Dana, who actually attended an Africa Imagination Creative Hub in Addis Ababa in May this year. And then there is also Samantha Zondi, who is the executive director of Indonesia, who is a on the conceptualization of Aspiration 5 of the African Union Agenda. And after that was a breakaway session where artists and other people in attendance talk about government and institutions of government and how they relate to Pan-Africanism. And of course there'll be other sessions where artists and fans discuss how the cultural and creative industries contribute to the promotion of the African cultural renewal and prosperity.
And then, Ms. Lomela, what does the seminar hope to achieve? At the end of the seminar, what do you hope will have been achieved when discussing the charter for African cultural renewal?
There are two things that the seminar wishes to achieve. The first one is to lay the philosophical and conceptual groundwork where people familiarize themselves with this very important data. We've got to popularize and create more awareness about it, apply for this official launch. And then the next thing is we've got to come up with practical ideas on how we are going to realize the implementation of this very important historic data. And then when we move into the future, we should be to see how we practicalize or realize the African Union Agenda 2063. We are all on the same construction framework or understanding, and we do not have issues when it comes to the discussion of whether Africa is one, do we promote diversity, what does this mean for smaller nations in the light of South Africa being perceived to be the imperialist, and all those kind of things that could prove to be a stumbling block. So we are adopting the culture to popularize it, and clearing whatever conceptual or intellectual hurdles that could come up.
That's Gandile Memela at the South African Department of Arts and Culture on the line talking to Tutonga Ben. Now moving on to something interesting here, bookkeeping. South Africa's basic education minister, Andy Mutsaha, has communicated an interest in studying the Brazilian school nutrition program, amongst others, in an effort to advance the South African model. Brazil feeds 45 million children daily in a program that seems to be the best worldwide. Spokesperson for the Department of Basic Education, Troy Martin, tells us more about these plans.
Where this comes from is the minister attended the World School Nutrition Conference, which was held in South Africa just this past week, ministers and deputy ministers and government officials from around the world, as well as different NGOs, descended on South Africa to discuss school nutrition. Mm. And different countries presented the different ways and different ideas around dealing with school nutrition. And what's interesting about the Brazilian model, and this is what the minister indicated was so wonderful about this conference, is that you get to see the experiences about the countries, the challenges that they face in delivering school nutrition, as well as some of the best practices that some may be able to use in other countries, and really share experiences. And the interesting thing about the Brazilian program was the sheer size of the program. Mm. It was indicated that they see around 45 million learners a day. Here in South Africa, we see just over 9 million learners a day, and those are in mostly paying schools in schools 1 to 3. So it really is a much smaller feeding program, and obviously we'd like to extend it to as many people as possible, and find the best ways to improve the efficiency of the way that we do things. So whether it's getting value for money with regards to the amount of learners that can be fed for a certain amount of food and what we're looking at. Mm. But what the minister also indicated that in South Africa, a one-size-fits-all approach like they have in Brazil may not work. Mm. We may need to look at different programs in different provinces, for instance, because as I'm sure you're aware, South Africa is a very diverse country with different socioeconomic activity in different provinces. So it might not work
across the board. Now, Troy, when we look at the South African model, I mean, we believe it's the fact that Germany there was just a little over 9 million children, whereas Brazil is dealing with 45, and they seem to be the best in the world at what they're doing. Now, one would think that, okay, if you're dealing with this number of people, that things should be running smoothly. What is it that has been working in the South African model, and what is it that's really been giving the minister sort of sleepless nights when it comes to the way that things are run in that department?
So what we have been doing is we have in the past appointed service providers to provide meals to schools.
Mm.
But what we've tested in the Eastern Cape in particular is to give the budget for nutrition to schools and let schools run the school nutrition program at a school-based level. Now what this has done is it's also stimulated economic activity in the community. It's helped women in particular in these communities, because they become the people who prepare the meals and who really provide the services to the school. And this way, when it's community run and school based, it really you really see an improvement in quality, because obviously these are the many mother to invested in feeling good, good value for money, good quality, and it's also provided in training.
Yeah.
Now, sorry,
and this is when you think about
Western tech.
Yeah, sorry, we just lost you a bit there, but we hear you now. When you think about you know, the things that the way that things are run, I mean, you spoke about earlier having used service providers to prepare the food and everything. But, you know, the model that you're using now seems to be working better because it's more community based and it's also advancing the community at a larger scale. Now, how much of a contribution has corruption played in sort of the department decided to actually not use service providers as opposed to the new system that they're using now?
It's not really a corruption issue that we are dealing with here. It's more of a value for money and a quality issue. Mm-hmm. And we also need to employ models and methods that really do ensure that we have the best quality and the best value for money. And that's really what it's about.
Yeah, and just before we actually go at point, there has been an incident, a very unfortunate incident, of course, of a kid who has died of food poisoning. Recently, and I just want to get a sense of the department's response to that particular case, because I know that investigations are still ongoing and there's been some speculation that the food was coming through the feeding scheme, while others are saying no, and it probably came from the home side. But how has the department received, I mean, these very tragic news of these kids that have died in this case?
Well, obviously, this is an absolutely tragic incident, and we do send our condolences to the family who have been affected, and especially considering that I think there's two of the learners come from the same family. So this is huge for that family. An investigation is ongoing by the province, and we await the finalization of that. Like we have indicated, there is speculation that the food was not from the school feeding.
Presented with 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 annual recognition of courageous reporting. Ong Za, Shemad Haderi, Mikhail Zigar, and Serial Hafaji have either faced imprisonment, violence, or censorship in the specific spaces they work in their respective countries. PJ's advocacy director, Courtney Raj, says these journalists are undeterred and unbound.
The Insurance of Hafaji Awards are awarded yearly by the Committee to Support Journalists in order to recognize the work that journalists around the world do in the face of adversity and danger. In general, we recognize journalists who are working in some of the most difficult environments, and I think that's the best topic this year, where we recognize reporters who work for editor-in-chief working in Russia. We recognize one of the longest running ex-patriot news sites, Aragorsky, and the founder and editor keep him there. And of course, we have had a conversation from Iraq, who was recently released from jail. So these awards are intended to bring, you know, to recognize not only the contributions of these journalists personally, but also the broader context in which they work. You know, Iran is one of the worst single journalists in the world. We want to raise awareness about the incredible racial community in Russia. And we believe that these awards help us both recognize the individual as well as the journalists in some of the most dangerous places in the world.
Courtney Raj, Advocacy Director for the Committee to Protect Journalists. This is Africa Digest. I'm Jazza Rod. Good to have you with us. Barbados Foreign Minister Maxine McLean says her country is leading by example in its transition to a green economy. Government buildings are already using renewable energy solutions. Bajans are also using creative and homegrown solutions to counter the negative effects of the changing weather. A small island developing state, SIDS, is also inspiring other islands in the Caribbean region to follow in its footsteps. Speaking to UN Radio's Justin Sambira in New York, McLean shares some measures the island has used to protect its coastline.
One of the things that we've been very proactive about is to
on support initiatives to protect our coastline. For example, we've done much work in the area of reconstructing and using science, and I would say science and technological initiatives to what is both a protection measure and also aesthetically attractive, and that is a series of boardwalks. This is intended to protect the coastlines, which has allowed our beaches, for example, to build themselves in many ways. And what this has done in terms of a benefit, it has created what I would describe as a recreational space for our visitors, for Barbadians, who are able to better enjoy our beaches because of the accretion of our beach space, so to speak. I think that is a strategy which we share with other island states as a mechanism of protecting our beaches. How much is this costing the country? I can tell you what it costs us right now to import oil. We spend approximately $800 million a year importing oil. If I put that in context, it is more than we spend in total for health as another individual category of expenditure on education. So as some major element of our national budget, we spend more on oil, the consumption and, you know, the purchase of fossil fuels. So what this means is that we are utilizing significant foreign exchange, because as we imagine, we have to earn hard currency and we have to spend hard currency. And so it is expensive, but we have put in place a number of mechanisms to encourage investment in renewable energy. I can expand on that. We have put a legislative framework in place to regulate the relationship between our electric company, Barbados Electric Power, and suppliers of the national grid, so that there is a structured way of supplying energy to the national grid. We've also put incentives in place at the domestic and enterprise level to encourage the citizen sector to invest in renewables. We've also put incentives in place for individual households. In addition to that, government has also seen it necessary to utilize renewable energy solutions on government buildings. So we are a government reinvestment.
What about at the household level? How are people feeling the impact?
I can share with you one example of a group of young university graduates who have been doing some research in solar energy, but they are researching in relation to agriculture. For example, with increased temperatures in the summer, persons who are in the business of solar production, for example, would find that their productivity, you know, in terms of the survival rate of daily six, etc., is negatively influenced by the heat. And the idea is, how do we reduce the ambient temperature? And these young people are working on solar energy solutions. And so it's that kind of creativity where people are saying we can identify problems, even if they're not manifested in their fullest at this point in time, but we anticipate the solutions. Let us look for solutions. What are some of the challenges that you're facing, and are there any possible solutions that you might be contemplating? We have a single power company, and so the issue is what becomes of the traditional energy generation effort of that company, and how does that company accommodate the power generators? And I think part of that would have to do with rethinking of the role of the company, for example. But in the interim, there are things that we have to manage the process by which people access, and that's where legislation has come in. The negotiation with the power company and with the regulatory body, which says, okay, we cannot open up the market one time, we have to have a phased approach. What we also recognize, and there's discussion at the regional and indeed the hemispheric level, of addressing the supply and consumption of energy. The fact that we are small might serve in the absence of other arrangements to as a disincentive to some companies and so on looking to get into the
market. Barbados Foreign Minister Maxine McLean talking to Union Radio's Joshua Sambira.
Thank you.
This is Channel Africa, South Africa's official international public radio station on shortwave, internet, and satellite. From an African perspective, listen to Channel Africa in English, Kiswahili, French, Norwegian, Portuguese, and Kenyan. The world about Africa. Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance. The International Monetary Fund is to give $130 million of financial assistance to 14 countries in West Africa. Hardship funding available to Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. Facing slowing growth and disruption in agriculture, mining, and services. Because we are great, more than 5,000 cases and over 2,600 deaths have been reported since the outbreak. And Sasha Mashlagu has this report.
The current outbreak in West Africa that cases reported in March 2014 is the last of the most complex Ebola outbreak since the virus was first discovered in 1976. There have been more cases and deaths in this outbreak than all others combined. It is also spread between countries such as Guinea, including the southern borders to Sierra Leone and Liberia, to Nigeria and to Senegal. The most severely affected countries, Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, have very weak health systems, lacking human and infrastructural resources, having only recently emerged from long periods of conflict and instability. Christine Lagarde, Managing Director of the International Monetary Fund, says the international community must ready to help the countries worst hit by the crisis.
So the Ebola virus is causing not only humanitarian terrible damage on both Sierra Leone, Chile, and Liberia, but it's also causing economic damage. So the three countries are our help, and today we have approved a package of $130 million that will go to support those three countries. The money is going to help the three countries as budget support. They clearly need to use those funds to fight the consequences of the virus. It's not going to cover all they need. There's more than that. It's about 30% of the currency, which is why it's so important that other international institutions, other donors actually contribute as well to support and help the three countries.
At the same time, the Vatican Department of Health has created the Ebola Response Fund to coordinate and manage relief assistance for the affected countries. The objective of the fund is to support South Africans' drive to assist the affected countries to have the social and humanitarian crisis that is unfolding in the region. The department has made an urgent call to the private sector to donate to the fund. It says the donation will be used to support the response to the unfolding crisis by setting up a 14-bed Ebola treatment unit in Sierra Leone, as well as with the provision of qualified people to staff the treatment unit, as well as support social mobilization efforts in the communities in affected countries. Dr. Andrea Tidero, president of the Coca-Cola Africa Foundation, says the response to the epidemic is so far not adequate.
I think everybody would agree that the response so far is not adequate. And I think the world is really waking up to the fact that this is a global problem, it is not a South African problem. And we saw that very, very starkly yesterday when a gentleman in Texas was diagnosed with Ebola. This is everybody's problem. The globe is starting to be more. You see the US has 10,000 even the government has seen the number of hospitals, the donations are increasing. But this is also a moving target. And so for us to have those kinds of impact, if you recall months ago, or say a little over a month ago, the medical community was asking for about $300 million. But now they're saying the minimum that would be required to stop this would be $1 billion. Even now, that may be outdated. So the response needs to be far bigger and much faster.
To say the Ebola Emergency Response Fund set up at the UN is a welcome move.
This body that has been created is around coordinating the response, giving the different organizations a central point from which to operate. It will also be a body that will enable the coordination of the various donations that are coming in, so that
information are going to where
they are
most needed. Meanwhile, an Ebola donor fund contributed by the UK in Sierra Leone government is underway in London. Its main agenda is to discuss what the global community can do to provide an effective international response to the epidemic.
to be stopped by the UK Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond, who has said his work would raise even greater awareness of the disease and that it needed to continue.
Now it's time for economic report. Yes, with Simon Tabula.
International Monetary Fund Managing Director Christine Lagarde says the global economy could be stuck in a weak growth rate for a long time. This has caused a struggle to push through from a path of high debt and unemployment. The economic rebound is even weaker than the IMF predicted 6 months ago, and countries risk getting bound to a prolonged period of sluggish growth, especially in the Eurozone. Lagarde also warned about financial risk. South Africa's consumer confidence has slipped by 5 points to minus 1 in the third quarter of the year compared to the previous quarter. It has remained below the long-term average reading of 5%. Analysts say delay elections temporarily strengthened consumer confidence levels during the second quarter. However, the outlook for consumer confidence was upbeat, with household incomes on the mend from the early strike in the platinum and engineering sector, while a lower petrol price should also support consumers' ability to spend. South African Public Funds Manager, Public Investment Corporation, PIC, is to sink $1 billion into African investments and equity punishments and company in the case. The PIC will focus on developmental investments in Africa. Nene also serves as the PIC's chairperson. He leads Africa's economic output and tripled over the past decade in the sub-Saharan region, projected to grow at 5% over the next 10 years. Nene says the African story represents the PIC with unique investment opportunities. And some OPEC countries becoming more worried about the drop in oil prices and calling for supply cuts. The different views within the first member organization of petroleum exporting countries highlights a split between Saudi Arabia and its Gulf Arab Emirates and other members, such as Iran, who face greater budget pressures from sub-$100 oil prices. Oil prices have fallen from $115 per barrel in June to below 1992 barrels a day today. And the financial indicators, the dollar trading at 11.28 per thousand rand, at 9.5 per pound of kilo, and 6.21 Zambian kwacha. Also trading 0.61 to the basic pound and 0.77 to the euro. Moving on now to the most better gold trading at $1,219. Platinum $1,287 a pound, and the third price of Brent is $94, 10,000 cents. That's how it's looking. It's on.
Fans and starting with the football news, the Zimbabwe Football Association is confident that that a stretch to the 2017 AFCON finals will yield positive results, Association submitted the 2017 AFCON Cup of Nations voting document to the Confederation of African Football on Monday, a day before the deadline of submission. UEFA Chief Executive Officer Jonathan Mashangaize is back from Cairo, Egypt, where he has got to submit the bidding document, which was finalized last Saturday. Mashangaize says, as UEFA, they are hopeful that Zimbabwe's proposal is comprehensive enough and can fully match those of their contenders. Federation came out in the open that they were not ready to host the first big competition. Zambia were not interested in receiving the best group of 2019 leaders. I found out that their government has issued the required guarantees.
Daniel here on Daniel.